How would you describe the evolution of your own style? I mean, sometimes you have this beautiful big Ori-like sound, and did that come in at a certain period, et cetera?
When I became aware of Ori. Well, I started as a Dickie Wells fan,
mm-hmm.
still am,
mm-hmm.
and then I became aware of Turk,
mm-hmm.
and became a Turk imitator.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I can safely say that I am the first of the Turk imitators.
When would that have been?
1942.
Okay.
We used to go over to the Dawn Club in 41 and through the early part of 42.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful experience hearing the Waters Band.
I can imagine.
In person. It was impossible to carry on a conversation. They were so loud, but they were rich. They had a big, rich, round sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a Turk imitator. I never was a big Turk fan.
Mm-hmm.
Although I am a great admirer of his part playing.
Mm-hmm.
The way he the broad way that he plays parts in the band. Let's see. Ori came. Oh,
How
Jim
did you
Robinson.
You become an imitator without being an admirer.
Hmm?
How did you become an imitator of his without being an admirer of his?
Oh, thought we might get a job at the Don Club. Boy, that sounds terrible, doesn't it?
But that was the absolutely, case. Absolutely honest in the way that jazz musicians operate sometimes.
Yeah. And, of course, I was, from listening to the Hot 5 records, I was aware of Ori,
mm-hmm.
and an Ori fan. And then later, Jim Robinson. Although I didn't become a real fan of Jim Robinson's until I saw him in person with the George Lewis band considerably later.
When would that have been?
Oh... When was that? Around 1950, more or less.
Still pretty damn energetic at that time.
Oh, yeah. That was one wonderful band.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And although when those Bunk American Music records came out, those 12 inches in 1945, I think,
mm-hmm.
That was great. Yeah, I was a Robinson fan then.
Mm-hmm.
That's another all-time great band, I think.
Yes.
Ori's band was at the CIO Hall at 150 Golden Gate Avenue in about 1945, too. Was it 45? Around then, give or take a year.
Mm-hmm.
45, 46. And I spent a lot of time there.
Hmm.
Another great all-time band.
Where was the CIO Hall?
In San Francisco... At 150 Golden Gate Avenue.
Because I know the Longshore Hall was used for certain events.
Oh, down there at the Embarcadero?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that came later. The Longshoremen's Hall was not built until after 1950, I think.
Where was the, there was the great, the Battle of the Bands? The 40, well, the Saunders King.
Yeah.
And Bunk Johnson. Bunk with the Yerba Buena, I guess it was.
Well, here is, as I recall, that set of affairs. At 150 Golden Gate in 1943, I think, 43, maybe carrying over into 44, although I don't think so. Bunk was playing with, as the record label puts it, former members of the Yerba Buena Jazz Band at 150 Golden Gate Avenue, the CIO Hall. I was in that band, by the way. And although my real function was acting as a placeholder for Turk, Turk would come in his Navy uniform and sit in much of the time. Well... Finally, the union, Local 6, found out that this was happening. They never have been known for their perspicacity, and it took them several months to discover that this was happening, although famous people like Jack Teagarden, Duke Ellington, Count Basie would make appearances on various Sunday afternoons just to hear what Bunk sounded like. But the union didn't know this was happening.
They would come and sit in, actually?
No, they wouldn't sit in. Okay. Just sit in the audience. I remember Basie sat off to one side backstage one time. So when the union found out this was happening, they put their foot down, their collective foot. They had a rule that racially mixed bands couldn't be. Yeah, you couldn't have white players and black players playing in the same band. That was the rule at that time with Local 6. So everybody was in the union.
White and black?
Yes.
In the same union?
No, there were two different unions. They were connected. I don't know if it I think it was called Local 6 Subsidiary at that time, the black local. At other times, it was called Local 669. But they were in administration, two different unions. So the white players quit playing, and Saunders King came in to that was a black band. A black swing band. They came in to back up Bunk.
Been described to me as a jump band.
Okay. Right. I don't know the distinctions between jump,
well,
swing, and so forth.
More of a small combo a la Louis Jordan as opposed to a sweet big band.
Oh, yes, exactly. Sure. And that didn't work out. Bunk didn't like them, and they didn't like Bunk. I don't know how Bunk felt about the jump band, but they thought he was an old fogey, and they swung differently. Bunk had his own way of swinging, and which was different from Saunders King's way of swinging. So unfortunately, that didn't work out.
Well, finishing up about the union, though.
Yes.
Helm describes to me a situation where they had divided the city and said that black players could play west of Van Ness, but not east of Van Ness. In other words, in the downtown and the hotel and Civic Center area. Does that ring a bell with you at all?
Doesn't ring a bell, but it makes sense. And if Helm says so, I'm sure that that is the way it was. Yeah.
Now, what span of time are we talking about that Bunk was doing this?
At the CAO Hall?
Yeah.
Okay. Less than a year. In 1943, maybe carrying over into 1944 a little bit.
Were you aware of him drinking a lot?
No.
No?
No, he drank beer, Bunk did, that I know of.
Okay.
That is, on the job.
Yeah.
I don't know what he did off the job. He seemed eminently reasonable, easy to deal with, easy to get along with, collected. He was never drunk on the stand. He was nothing approaching that. And when I read, when I have read about Bunk and his behavior in books about how he was in at the Stuyvesant Casino and in Boston, he sounds like a different person entirely than the man that was out here in 1943. One thing about Bunk, he when there would be an important occasion like around the world broadcast, one was set up by the BBC at that time. From emanating from the studios KGO or KPO at on O'Farrell Street. There were the BBC was setting up something where there would be a segment from one city, and then they'd of a few minutes, and they'd move on to another city, and so forth, all the way around the world. Well, Bunk didn't show up for this. He finally did stumble into the studio, really drunk, and in no condition to play, and far too late to do any playing, even if he were in condition to do so. Someone in the band wrote out the lead to Down by the Riverside, which was Bunk's theme song. Mm-hmm. And at that time, radio stations all had house bands. And so they got the trumpet player, Harlow Burgess, from the, I guess it was KGO house band, to come in and read it off with us. And it was announced that this was Bunk Johnson and his band.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was spurious. But he just played the straight lead, and we played our usual parts for a couple of choruses, and that was it. But there was another time that, an important occasion that Bunk didn't show up until too late, and he was too drunk to function. Mm-hmm. But he was great, in full control of things on the unimportant occasions.
These would be for dancing. You're playing for dancing, in the unimportant occasions.
Yes, now there was no dancing at the CIO Hall when Bunk was playing there. The floor was completely filled with folding chairs.
Oh, I see.
Later, when Ori was there, there was plenty of dancing.
I see.
But not when not in 43 when Bunk was playing there.
More of a concert.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But if it was going to attract a lot of attention, or the attention of important people, Bunk seemed to prepare himself too fully, I think, so he wouldn't be nervous.
He was the leader of the band, right?
Definitely.
And did he function as most leaders function, or did
yes.
he have a certain style to how he did that?
Oh, yes. Yes. He would start the tunes by stomping his heel on the wooden floor twice on beats one and three.
Mm-hmm.
Just one bar, and we'd start playing. Mm-hmm. And then to end the piece, to let us know when we were about to end it, he would give two stomps with his heel, but out of time, about 8 bars from the end. And that way we would know we were going to quit.
Mm-hmm. How did he call the tune? You just say the name, or did he play a bar on his horn?
Ah, this requires a little recollection.
I ask.
No, he would say the name.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Some of the older musicians have trouble remembering the name in New Orleans, and they play a couple of licks or something. That's why I asked that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I know. Some players who ask, how does it go when the name is called? to wit, me.
who else was in the band with Bunk at that time that you were?
At the CIO home?
Yeah.
Ellis Horn. Bert Bales on piano. Ellis Horn plays clarinet. Bert Bales on piano. Pat Patton on string bass or banjo, sometimes Gershback on tuba or string bass, Bill Dart on drums, I think sometimes Clancy played drums. Clancy played drums at the Dawn Club earlier. Let me see now. Who have I left out? Me, alternating with Turk. Who have I left out?
Piano? Oh, Bert Bales. Yeah. I think you've got them all.
Yeah. And you played subsequently with Bales after that, didn't you?
Oh, quite a bit, yeah.
Why don't you talk about Bert a little and maybe some of the jobs or a story or you can think of something?
I used to like to... I lived around the corner from Bert for a while, Bert and his wife, Jean. I was living at Maul Waters' house at 24 Steiner Street, and Bert was living around the corner in an alley called Lily Street.
Wait a minute, you said Ma Waters?
Ma Waters, yeah.
Lou's mother?
Yes.
Wait a minute, let's divert just a minute. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Lou's mother rented a flat, that is the entire top floor of an old frame house, well, a typical San Francisco house at number 24 Steiner Street. That's at DeBose and Steiner. And Lou lived there for a while. And he moved out. At the time I was living there, Gershbach lived there. Gershbach had a room there. Forrest Brown had a room there. Forrest Brown was a piano player and bass player.
A room in this one big flat?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And Lou's half-sister, Lina, lived there. And a guy named, an old guy named Witt lived there. That's all I know of his name. And Ma Waters. And we all had kitchen privileges. And Lou's parrot was there, too, and living in Ma Waters' part of the apartment.
Did the parrot talk?
The parrot? Yes. Lina, Lou's half sister, was a sort of nervous woman, a pleasant woman, but a little nervous. And sometimes the parrot would call out, "Lina, telephone." Poor Lina would come out and go toward the telephone. She never did know when it was Ma Waters speaking or the parrot.
Did Ma Waters put the parrot up to this, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think that it was just an ornery parrot. I think it just picked up on this on the natural. And
Was there ever music played there?
No. Not live music, except a little practicing, I guess, and playing of records, but quietly. It was not a musical apartment.
But it did give you a chance to get, better acquainted with Lou?
Not with Lou. He wasn't living there.
Oh, okay.
He would show up every now and then. Sometimes he and his wife, Pat, would show up and have a terrible quarrel. They'd be drunk and they'd be yelling at each other. And I don't think they actually threw anything at each other, but they'd be yelling at each other with strong language and loud. But I knew Gershbach and Forrest Brown. In fact, Forrest Brown and I shared a room for a while.
Tell me a little about Forrest.
Well, he was an orphan. He was an orphan. Forrest Brown was not his born name. I don't think he had a born name, but early in his life, it was conferred on him, and this very euphonious name.
Mm-hmm.
And
did he play? What was his instrument?
Oh, he played piano and string bass. I don't know which was his primary instrument, probably string bass. And he'd been around, like all these guys, since the early 30s. I think they all joined the union around 30, 31, 32.
They're maybe 10 years older than you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And
he was in on the very foundations of the Yerba Buena band, wasn't he?
I think he was. I've read that he was.
They were rehearsing in the East Bay.
Yeah, at the Big Bear.
I've only read it. I don't know.
Me too. Yeah. That Forrest drank too much. Forrest, eventually he died of cirrhosis.
Was he a good piano player?
Yeah, he was a mainstream, run-of-the-mill piano player.
Mm-hmm. He's not a student of old records and trying to do Jelly Roll style or something.
No, he
like
didn't
that.
Do that.
Yeah.
No. That was a rather late development with those guys, I think, with Lingle and Burt.
Mm-hmm.
Discovering the Morton piano
yes,
literature.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So let's get back to Burt Bales.
Yes, okay. So he lived around the corner, and I used to like to go around and sit in his living room in the afternoon and listen to records and talk to Burt. Burt was...
Would he have been older than you?
Oh, yes. Again, about 10 years older than me. And he was kind of a wiggy guy, Burt.
How so?
I mean, he had original ideas on political matters, and he had a, my impression was he had a rather high IQ, Burt. And he was interesting and fun to talk to and to listen to hold forth.
We're talking now the period when you're living in this flat.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
Now, what period was that exactly?
48.
48.
Yeah, 48, 49.
You were there for?
47, maybe. 47, 48, yeah.
About a year you were there?
Yeah, a year or two.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then Burt was working at a place called the 1018 Club on Fillmore Street. Now, Fillmore, Sinus Street is just one block from Fillmore. And so it was an easy walk over the hill and down the other side toward walking north. And the 1018 Club was a big square room lined in tile, white tile, like a bathroom. And Burt had a pedestal right in the middle of the room, as I recall, or maybe off to one side. Anyway, there was a piano about 3 feet off the floor on a small platform. And Burt would sit up there and from time to time ask if anybody was going to buy the piano player a drink. And he'd play his marvelous stuff. He was at the top of his form then. And
what sort of stuff would he play?
Oh, he would play Fats stuff, and he would play Jelly Roll stuff. He, of course, he would play, some of the Blackbirds numbers, like Sweet Savannah Sue. I don't know if that's a Blackbirds number, but tunes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Original Rags was one of his favorite numbers.
I know Whinin' Boy was in his book for a long time.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't singing much then. He later started to sing Whinin' Boy.
What was his relationship to the Waters group? In other words, that was more Wally Rose, right?
Yeah.
So I mostly know it just from the track that records have left, but that's sometimes an artificial track to what was really happening.
Well, what did Wally do? I'm not sure. Did Wally go in the Navy?
I don't know.
I'm not sure either. But he wasn't around the Dawn Club. And
who?
Wally.
He wasn't?
No. He in 42, I mean, when the guys were going into the service.
Mm-hmm.
He, for whatever reason, I think he went in the Navy.
Mm-hmm. But so Burt was playing with that band.
That's right. So Burt was playing, as you say, with that band. Now, how he first met up with these guys, I don't know.
But he was also worked as a single a lot, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
You're saying.
Yes, that's right. When it became apparent that the club was going to close, the Dawn Club mm-hmm. was going to close, you could see the signs. They were in trouble with the tax people.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bert went up to the Tenderloin, which at that time was not nearly as scruffy as it is now. And I remember he took me along one time and went to two or three places and sat in, sort of auditioning himself,
mm-hmm.
Which was really not unethical because there was a shortage of players then.
Oh.
People going into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And so he made it apparent. He let people know that he was available to play singles. And he did around the Tenderloin. The Tenderloin was full of little bars with piano players.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them even had bands.
How much would a guy get like him get paid in a night?
At that time?
Yeah.
It's a tough one because inflation has changed things so much.
$10, $20?
I guess it would be around $20.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see now. Thinking back, maybe 30. 20 or 30, plus tips, and the tips would be as much, if not more, than the salary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then what about cover charge at these places? They charge 50 cents, a dollar?
A minimum charge?
Yeah.
Well, probably 50 cents. 50 cents a drink. They were clip joints, of course. They'd water the drinks and so forth, all that goes with that. But they were very pleasant to be around.
The B-girls there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It was all very pleasant, as I recall.
You were only about 20 then. Huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You got a good education.
Yeah. I played in, later on, after that, I played in Tenderloin places with floor shows yet. Five-piece bands. Yeah. I played at the Chez Paris and the streets of Paris. But this is getting away from Bert. So Bert, most of his career was as a solo piano player
mm-hmm.
in places like the 1018 and the Tenderloin places.
Mm-hmm. And later, of course, the Tin Angel, I mean the Pier 23 and all that.
Oh, that's right, later. Yeah, yeah.
But see, then he was on those first Turk Murphy records, which I find great, you know.
Uh-huh.
My question about his relationship with them is, I personally favor his conception of rhythm over Murphy's, for example.
Oh,
that's why I like that first band.
Yeah.
But I wondered how he and Murphy got along or how that worked.
Well, everybody got along fine with Bert.
Yeah.
And unless they were playing in his band with Turk, I guess, too. I never played in Turk's band.
Mm, of course.
And I understand it was a strange experience, but Bert was very easy to get along with, very accommodating, very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
A really good guy.
I found him so in late years. That's the only time I knew him.
Yeah. Well, he always was.
How about when he drank?
That's very interesting, because I played in bands that Bert had, and over at Victor's and Roxy's in Oakland, he had a band, and I played in that one, and he was able to. He had this. This is the way it worked. He would play beautifully right up till 2 o'clock when the band stopped, no matter how much he had had to drink. He was right there, solid as a rock. And then after two, if he stuck around, locked the door, have a few drinks, and continue playing just because he felt like playing. He couldn't play anything. He'd fall apart. He was not making it. So he had this really professional knack of holding himself together as long as he had to.
And as long as there were other players around him.
Yes. Even after hours, though, if the other rest of the band was there, he still couldn't get it.
So it was performance that he was up.
That's right.
Performance, and then afterwards it was disorganized.
Right, exactly.
Wow.